Who wants to be a millionaire? If you want to build wealth, start with your mindset. In this episode, we focus on the lessons taught in the books by Thomas J. Stanley. Starting with The Millionaire Next Door, we take a look at some of the traits that millionaires share, and we discuss the changes you can make today to begin building toward your millionaire status for the future. For show notes, head over to moneymastermindshow.com/episode41. Visit moneymastermindshow.com/audible to download a free audiobook. And remember, you can get this podcast and all its episodes delivered to you free by subscribing in iTunes and Stitcher. And now, here's the show.
Welcome to the Money Mastermind Show. Let's talk money.
And welcome to the Money Mastermind Show. Tonight, we are talking about what makes up the millionaire mind. We have Miranda Marquit of Planting Money Seeds, Peter Anderson of Bible Money Matters, Kyle Privo of youngandthrifty.ca, Tom Drake of the Canadian Finance Blog, and myself, Glenn Craig of Free From Broke. What makes one person a millionaire and another one isn't? You know, what's the difference? Is it just luck? Is it better investing? I mean, I think there's a little bit more to it, and I think that's what we're going to get into tonight. So where do we start?
Well, you can kind of maybe start looking at what some of the attributes of people who end up being millionaires. You know, obviously there are people who are millionaires that have been born into wealth. Large majority of people that end up being millionaires are people that have are first generation millionaires. They've worked and they built a business, or they're entrepreneurs or whatever, and they've actually built their fortune. What are some of the things that those people do that enable them to become millionaires? In his book, Millionaire Next Door, Thomas J. Stanley, who just passed away a couple weeks ago here, I think that's partly why we're doing the show, but in his book, he talks about millionaires, and he looked at millionaires cross-country and found some of the attributes that they had in common. One of the ones that might be obvious, but all of them tend to have in common, is that they live below their means. They're frugal, and they make a decent income, but they don't splurge and spend it all. They tend to drive older cars, live in a median priced house, and they don't spend a lot on luxuries. So,
right. And one of the things that I really loved about this book and what he mentioned was when he talked about the most popular car amongst millionaires being a Toyota, right? And you look at that and you say, really, a Toyota? Like, the most popular car amongst millionaires isn't a Cadillac or some other expensive sports car. It's a Toyota. And I think that tells you a lot about what it takes to have a true wealth mindset.
I think the book could probably be subtitled like the anti Keeping Up with the Joneses book.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, find what everybody's doing out there that maybe you're envious about, and do the opposite. And
right.
You might be on the road to wealth, unless you happen to be really living in a great neighborhood where everybody's really on track. But
right. And that's really one of the traits he mentions in the book, is financial independence is more important than the material things that in our society indicate status. So he does specifically talk about, it's not about what we view as looking rich, you're actually building wealth. And so there's a difference between looking rich and trying to put that image out there and say, look at me, I'm living this lifestyle, this lavish lifestyle. You're probably really not rich. You're probably living that lavish lifestyle on debt.
Yeah, you mentioned how millionaires are big owners of Toyotas, and there's a reason for that. Because millionaires are buying for quality and for value. Toyotas were shown to be, by Consumer Reports, to be the most reliable vehicle after 5 years of ownership. So right there, they're buying a vehicle that they know is high quality, that's going to last them a long time, and it's not going to be just a status symbol. It's a utilitarian device. But like you guys were saying, it's you know what society sees when they think of a millionaire is completely different than what the actual reality is. The Wall Street Journal did a study of 2,000 people, and they found that 35% believe that in order to qualify as being rich, a person must drive a car that costs $75,000 or more. And Stanley said that when he applied that threshold to millionaires who he surveyed, more than 90% would fail to qualify. So, you know, that shows the real disconnect there between perception and reality.
For sure, we've had this, you know, keeping up with the Joneses is nothing new. It's been going around for a long time. But it seems like lately this whole, maybe it's the reality TV or, you know, I'm not sure what it is exactly, but it just seems like the image of what a millionaire is supposed to be has gotten so much more extravagant these days. So it's not even just the car that you're driving. It's what you're wearing. It's your entourage around you. And it's like, you know, you see these sports guys doing this and then these musicians doing this and these actors doing this. And you think like you have to have this whole kind of crazy circus going on around you. And that's what wealth is all about.
You know what I noticed, Glenn, is in addition to you having a posse in a circus, your children do. As a teacher, keeping up with the Joneses isn't just about you. I see kids coming to school, and it is crazy. I joke around that kids in our school leave iPhones and smartphones and iPods. They just leave them lying around, and they're never worried about anyone stealing them. And we live in a middle-class rural area. We're not in the Hamptons here. And people aren't worried about them stealing them because literally every single kid has a smartphone. So in addition to many other things, and these aren't like old smartphones. These are like $700 pieces of equipment. And every single kid, grade 7 and above, has one. I'd say over 80%, probably over 90% have one. In addition to the latest designer clothes, I mean, I didn't go to school with like rags on my knees, but this is like a whole new level of keeping up with the Joneses for me when you're like Facebook posting pictures of your kids and it's almost like a dog showing contest or something.
Yeah, or Instagram, you're just showing everybody, you know, what you have right now. This is what I've got. Look at me. You know, yeah, there's no, I don't know what
you,
it
like,
is.
Warp your kids into that mindset. You're like, oh, compete, like status symbol. It starts young, right?
I'm totally doing this wrong. All of my Instagram pictures of my son are like pictures of him playing the piano or doing a science project. Clearly, I need to adjust my priorities.
You have to bling out the piano.
He's hanging out with the new immigrant students that will be running both Canada and the USA very soon then.
Actually, yes, he is, to tell the truth. His best friend is in fact one of the so-called desirable minorities. So, yes.
Nice.
So let's go back
to talk about the kids.
Oh, go ahead. No.
I was going to say, you're talking about the kids having this consumerist behavior as well. And that's actually one of the things that Stanley talks about in his book is millionaires have children that are economically self-sufficient. They're able to, figure out these things on their own and live their own frugal lifestyle. And they're not receiving a lot of care, financial care, especially from their parents. They're able to go out on their own and get a job and not rely on their parents later on for income or whatever.
Well, what was that thing a few years ago, that big deal when Warren Buffett announced that all of his money after he died was not going to his kids, it was going to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation? You know, here's Warren Buffett, one of the richest men in the world, and he's just like, yeah, no, I'm not leaving all of my – I mean, I'm sure his kids get plenty of money for whatever they need if they need
it. But he takes care of all their educations maybe.
Yeah, but he doesn't run around. He's not building this big legacy to just bequeath them with later. It's going somewhere else.
But wasn't something else in the book, and it's been a little while since I've given it a good thorough read, but he said something along the lines of, I mean, not only talking about the first generation wealth, but that a lot of the wealth disappears within like one or two generations also, right? Because of mismanagement. Bootstrap and you work hard and do all the right things, you become a millionaire. But then sometimes there's that disconnect for the generations that follow coming up, and they don't necessarily have all of those same traits that got them there in the first place.
Yeah, I think he does talk about, a lot of these millionaires that are making a fortune are doing it in ways that, they're doing blue-collar type things. You know, maybe they start a junkyard or they're an auctioneer or whatever, and they've had to work really hard for everything that they've gotten. And that they obviously want a lot of the times to have their kids live a better life than they did. But in the process, by giving them everything that they want, they end up short-circuiting a lot of the things that caused them to gain that wealth in the first place. The living below their means, the not worrying about keeping up with the Joneses, being economically self-sufficient, all those things. They tend to short-circuit those things.
And yeah, that's a tough concept, right? I mean, I, as a parent, you know, I remember what it was like to be a kid and want like the latest G.I. Joe and Transformer and everything else. And it's like, you want to be able to somehow do better. You know, not that my folks were bad at all, but, you know, give them more. It's a fine line to not cross over and do too much and spoil them.
Yeah, you guys got me thinking, because I remember being amazed at the Buffett sort of family scenario and quote. So I got a Buffett quote here. I looked up quick. It said, "My family won't receive huge amounts of my net worth. That doesn't mean they'll get nothing. My children have already received some money from me and Susie and will receive more. I still believe in the philosophy that a very rich person should leave his kids enough to do anything, but not enough to do nothing." That's a typical Warren Buffett. You think about that and you're like, folksy wisdom. I like that.
Well, and actually, one of the things I like about Warren Buffett, if we go back to what we were talking about before with keeping up with the Joneses and all the trappings of a wealthy lifestyle, the man lives in the same home he bought like decades ago in Omaha, and he does not have a yacht. When you think of rich people, you're like partying on a yacht with booze, right? But Warren Buffett doesn't even have a yacht. I don't know what you'd do with a yacht in Omaha, but
maybe that's
he's rich enough that he could keep a yacht somewhere else.
But that does touch upon it, right? Because he's living somewhere where he doesn't need to have a yacht in order to say, "Hey, look, I'm wealthy." You know, he's living in an area that's probably not full of like giant McMansions and all sorts of craziness too. So he doesn't feel the need to put on that show. I mean, he's the type of guy, maybe he wouldn't do that anyway, right? Because I think we know enough about him that he wouldn't. But, I mean, your surroundings.
Warren Buffett just himself is enough.
Yeah, I mean, like you were talking about yachts, and I just got this image of him in like a bathing suit hanging off a yacht, and it just doesn't work. But, you know, sometimes just where you live is going to have a big determinant factor of your road to millionaire or how easy or hard it'll be.
I think there's definitely something to that, Glenn. Like, I think the area I live in would shock people. The amount of millionaires per capita, I think, would really shock people. And it's because the farming sort of ethos that I live around, where it's mostly rural guys who grew up on the land, it's like a competition to be frugal. Like, if you talk to people, it's like, "Oh God, that crazy fool bought a new truck. Like, what a moron," which is like somewhat negative in its own way, but it certainly is a different type of peer pressure that would lend itself to building wealth and sort of that always save for a rainy day philosophy that a lot of sort of agricultural people seem to embody a little bit.
But here it's the exact opposite. We're not that far away, Kyle. And totally the opposite. If you're not in a new vehicle within the last 2 years, then everybody's kind of looking at you like, "Well, are you not successful? What are you doing? Why don't you have a new car?" So it's totally the opposite.
So it's not a Canadian thing.
No.
I would say where the little area I have would be like a similar to what Americans, when they think of Omaha and they think of that prairie. Yeah. I don't know. Even if you wanted to spend money, it's like there's no Wolf of Wall Street walking around. Like there'd be no one to compete with. You'd be the odd one standing out, right?
So where you live is going to have a big factor in whether you're a millionaire or not. You know, what trappings do you have to keep up with? What's the cost of living there? Taxes. You know, these are all drains on your own personal economy that you have to overcome to get to that millionaire status.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Thomas Stanley, in a post a year or so ago, wrote about auctioneers who have to be 10 times more likely to be a millionaire than the average person. And one of the main reasons, one of the big reasons he mentioned why they were, because a lot of times they tend to live in areas with a lower cost of living and less pressure to acquire those status symbols that are negative for your financial health, you know, the expensive cars, the huge expensive houses and so forth. Just like you guys were talking about, that living that lower cost of living area can be huge for your wealth building.
I think it's also important to note that it's not just about keeping your costs low either. One of the things that Thomas Stanley mentions in The Millionaire Next Door is that they use their resources, their money, their time, their energy, all of that stuff. They use those resources and they direct them in ways that help them build wealth as well. And it's not just about pinching pennies and keeping track of your cost of living, although that helps. And that's a big part of staying within your means. But he also talks about taking the steps to make it happen, to move forward, to use your time wisely in a way that helps you build wealth rather than, you know, watching TV every time the American Time Use Survey comes out and you look at like the amount of time people spend watching TV, and then you add that to the amount of time on average people spend surfing the internet. By the time you're done with all of that stuff, you're at like 3 or 4 hours a day. And that's like a part-time job, right?
So that's not productive?
I know, shocking.
Yep, I think that was a big point of his book too, is that they spend time in ways that promotes building wealth. So they're spending time to plan ahead, to budget, set goals for the future. And he found that people who were great accumulators of wealth, higher than even other high income folk, they spend almost twice as much time planning and working towards those goals every month. So they were spending that time working towards that goal.
There's nothing wrong with TV. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with TV, because I love me some TV. But at the same time, you know, there's one thing of like watching an episode or two in the evening to kind of unwind before you go to bed. And then it's another thing to be like, I'm going to spend 3 hours watching TV and then 2 hours surfing the internet, and suddenly 5 hours are gone. And what do you have to show for it?
It can be like a huge addictive sinkhole. I mean, I don't think anybody really intends to like flip on the TV and sit on the couch and get lost for like 4 hours, but that just seems to be what happens, right? And I think this is a theme that we've touched on the show a number of times, that just like, you know, if you want to be more productive in whatever you want to do, watch less TV, get off Facebook, do something that's going to push you forward rather than just kind of keep you standing still. So I think that's it's a major factor there that we can check off on our list of millionaire traits. Now, I want to jump back to something that Peter had mentioned, and that was, you know, living below your means and being frugal. And I think frugality became very popular after 2008, you know, when we had the economic crash. But I think it maybe went so far that there's now a rebound, and it's you know, maybe approaching that dirty word status again, where it's like, oh, you know, you're frugal, you must be getting your food out of a dumpster then.
But
it's not necessarily the case, though, right? I mean, frugal is not a dirty word. So what does that mean to you guys?
Doesn't necessarily mean not ever spending money. I mean, I think he delves into that topic where, you know, millionaires do spend money on things that they will get true value out of. You know, they'll buy a nice pair of shoes or a nice suit, but they're not going to be spending a ton of money on these things. They're going to buy a nice suit at, you know, off the rack from somewhere. They're not going to spend $10,000 for a custom suit. You know, they'll buy something for value, but they're not going to spend money on status symbols.
It goes back to that core, well, what matters to you and what is really important to you? I always sound like a broken record, because that's my mantra. Between figuring out your values and indexing when you invest, I mean, that's all there is to my life. That's my entire financial plan right there, is figure out your values and then invest in index funds. I think it's not so much about being frugal and trying to pinch pennies as it is about getting clear about your priorities and then kind of arranging your financial resources around your priorities. And I think that's one of the points he makes in the book, is they take a look at what matters. They're not spending money on crazy toys and status symbols, and they're figuring out what matters to them. And you read about like the millionaire next door, and they don't need big, huge, fancy vacations all the time. And they don't need a big, huge house, and they don't need the finest clothes and the most expensive car. I mean, they're driving Toyotas, for heaven's sake. So I think that it really goes back to, what is enough, and what do you really value in terms of true wealth? Do you want to be truly wealthy, or do you want to look like society's image of somebody who has wealth?
But that's the interesting thing, though, is that by being even sort of moderately frugal, or I live a life that my grandparents would have thought of as like quite opulent, quite luxury based, because to them, frankly, a hot shower was a luxury. And so to me, it's like, oh, great. Like I enjoy these simple luxuries, right? But in the modern setting, we took the whole continuum and just shifted it insanely amount. Like a new Toyota is now considered frugal, right? Because, well, you didn't buy the $60,000 car or truck, right? So it's an interesting, if you are going to make a commitment to do this, you should know that, like, you don't just become a millionaire overnight, and that obviously you will pay a bit of a social price, or you might have to defend yourself a little bit or get used to the idea that people are going to be like, well, I mean, come on now, like you're still driving that 13-year-old van, or you're really, you're only taking a driving trip this year to see a local landmark instead of a flight across the world or down to the Caribbean or whatever the case may be. You know, don't you guys both have good jobs? So you're going to get a little bit of that. But I think if you keep the goal in mind, for me, at least, that really helps the idea of wealth building to just sort of keep, like we talked to Todd last week about, just keeping the goal in mind and foremost.
You don't have to worry about having all this stuff now. Think about it maybe as a game where you could be the last one that laughs. When you're ready to retire and just kind of have fun, do what you want, you now have the wealth to actually do it. You know, and maybe not even before then. You could certainly, if you take care of your money, your money will take care of you down the road as well.
The other thing I really liked from the book was he talks about choosing the right occupation. And we've talked about this a little bit before too, but he talks about, hey, that's great that you want to follow your dreams, but let's be realistic about what your dreams are going to pay you. One of the interesting things in the book, how realistic that was, let's pick the right occupation here.
And even in the right occupation, I think he even discusses how if you're a high power lawyer, you're almost expected to look that part. Hmm. You know, so coming with expenses and just going to school, if you're a big corporate lawyer, you're expected to show up in the expensive suit and the expensive car. Because otherwise the corporation's going to go, well, why are we going to hire you? You're not making enough to afford all of this stuff. So it's not even like, oh, you know, I'm trying to be an art student and I got a 4-year degree and spent $100,000 on it and there's no job. It's like, even if there is a job, sometimes you have to put on an air with that job that's going to cost you too. So you really do have to think a lot about what you want to do.
I was waiting for somebody else to say something because I talked so much. So come on.
I think we've talked a lot on the show just about choosing the right career and being familiar with today's job market. Look back at our other episodes. If you're listening in on this, and just see how much we all love fine arts degrees going $150,000 in debt. That's like, one thing we love. We promote that lifestyle on the Money Mastermind Show week in and week out.
And nothing with, at least personally, nothing with the art majors or anybody's doing the liberal arts. You just can't spend all of your money on that degree and get into a ridiculous amount of debt when you're not going to have a salary that will pay it off afterwards. And that's the thought down the line that you have to consider.
I was reading a post on Quora, and it was basically how did you make your first million? It was somebody asked the question, and the question was answered by, I don't know, 10 or 12 different people that had made their first millions relatively young. You know, they were asking them how they had did that. One of the things that was common to a lot of these people was that they were very strategic about their career. They chose career paths that they knew were going to be high paying, or they could avoid schooling that they didn't need. They did that, or they found ways to get the right job at the right time in order to be the most profitable to them. So they were very strategic about where they were working, when they were working there, and all those types of things.
And that dovetails quite nicely into yet another trait of millionaires that Thomas J. Stanley says. In his book, he talks about targeting their market opportunities and paying attention to where you're at and being ready to like create your own luck or at least take advantage of what's there. And I think that is a really good point. Kind of have to be realistic and look at it and say, well, can my dreams pay the rent? You have everybody, all these people are like, oh, well, I'm just going to follow my passion and it'll work out. And I don't know that it will. I mean, you have to target these opportunities. You have to look for them.
You have to work. Right?
I mean, no. Nobody has to work. It all just comes to you. What are you talking about, work?
No one's going to listen to this podcast if we tell people they have to work. Straight up. The Money Mastermind way is pick stocks, penny stocks, play risk a little, and just dream.
What's the one weird thing I can do?
Magic.
Well, I was going to bring out an interesting point, though, in that, you know, there are people who do win the lottery, right? Or, you know, Uncle Bob passes away and leaves you those secret millions that he had. Even if you make that instant million, if you don't have everything in order and your values in place, that money's going to go very quickly. You don't have to go far to find stories about people who won the lottery that lost it all and are even more miserable afterwards than they were before. You know, and I think every one of us will say, well, that's a great problem to have. I'd love to tackle that myself. But still, it does happen where they end up bankrupt, and here they are. They were millionaires.
I had a instructor in a business class once who talked about how you could give somebody who has no idea how money works, give them $1 million and they'll blow it and it'll be done with and they'll be back to where they were before you gave them their $1 million. But if you take somebody who understands how money works and gets it, you can take away all of their money, leave them with $1, and they will find a way to regain all that they had lost and move forward. And a lot of it has to do with, do you understand how money works and do you know how to make it work for you? And do you know how to make an investment in yourself in a way that is marketable and profitable?
And I think the inheritance stuff you brought up, Glenn, is very pertinent. On the front cover of Maclean's, which is our major news magazine in Canada here, a couple weeks ago, there was a big article about the huge passing of wealth that's going to happen from one generation to the other. And it always completely stuns me that people have no idea what to do with an inheritance, whether it's even $20,000, which is, it's not the lottery, but it's, you know, quite a nice, you know, it's a substantial amount of wealth for a lot of people, including myself. It represents a substantial opportunity to you know, help build wealth. Exactly what we've talked about, exactly what Peter was saying, with various different sort of wealth building strategies that Thomas J. Stanley and others have put forward. And instead people are like, oh, you know, my loved one from beyond the grave would love for me to just spend this money on XYZ. And I don't know, maybe in a specific case that's true. I don't want to offend anyone, but I tend to believe that people are going to waste a substantial opportunity in the coming years to really, really set themselves up and perhaps their children in a more stable financial position going forward if they do sort of the smart money thing with their inheritance.
Do you think that there's a trust issue in financial advisors and like people who come into money like that, they're just kind of maybe afraid to go to the wrong person? I mean, there's certainly been a lot in the media since the financial crisis, bankers, bad people, not that they all are, but you know, it's like this stigma against Wall Street. So people are like, look, I can't trust them with the money. You know, I don't know what's going to go with the market. Should I just spend it now?
A former guest of this show, Andrew Hlam, actually wrote in his book, The Millionaire Teacher, that when Google started to get huge relatively quickly and started to share shares of the company and people were trading on secondary stock exchanges, they had to prepare their employees for this, you know, these guys who had really, they were tech guys. A lot of them had no experience with money. They had to prepare them for this influx of wealth. And they brought in all these fellows from Princeton. They brought in John Bogle. I think they brought in Mr. Malkiel, amongst others. And they basically explained how money works and told them what advisors would say and sort of how to arm themselves with knowledge. And then when all the advisors poured in, none of the guys from Google wanted anything to do with them. I just thought that was quite an interesting story of a sudden influx of wealth and a company that took it upon themselves to sort of prepare their employees for that.
So how do we go about preparing the audience or everybody else out there? I mean, I think we kind of figure out what, you know, like a John Bogle would say, maybe, you know, there you go.
That's what John Bogle would say. He would say index. So, and buy from Vanguard while you're at it.
Then you'd say mean things about mutual fund people.
Well, I was just going to, take a more, I don't know, cynical view of humanity, I guess, and say, I think one of the reasons why people wouldn't trust financial advisors with their money is not so much that they wouldn't trust financial advisors with their money, is that they feel like, I mean, when you're dropped with this huge amount of money, you feel like it's never going to end. It's there and it's, and you'll never run out of it. And so you can just spend it, because think about $1 million. If you had $1 million dropped in your lap, emotionally, you're like, I could never spend all of this. It will last forever. And I think a lot
I could spend it quickly.
Well, I know I could, but I think, even if I think about like $20,000, I'm like, oh man, you know, that could last a long time. I mean, it really wouldn't when I really stop and think about it. But when you have these big numbers, your mind doesn't think about it in the same way. And you kind of get stuck in this idea of, oh, well, it's never going to disappear. I can never get rid of it. And you have this thing where you can just fling money about and not have to worry about it because it's such a huge number. And I think that's part of the issue too, is because it's like, well, it's this huge number and how will I ever get through it all? I never will. I don't have to worry. And a lot of us, when we, especially with the $1 million mark, we're like, oh, if I had $1 million, I would never have to worry about anything ever again.
You touch on something there in that you know, maybe it's not the money and what it can buy that really builds wealth for a millionaire, what the money can generate. You know,
definitely.
Like you could buy a house, you could buy a bunch of cars, you could buy a whole bunch of stuff, and $1 million will go quickly. Or you look at it like, well, I now have this $1 million wealth building vehicle. You know, what can I do with this money? Even if I just put it into something safe that would generate, you know, income for me. That's, I think, maybe a key trait of what makes a lot of people millionaires. You know, how can I make money do something else with it than just buy me stuff?
And that's exactly why they're millionaires to begin with, is because they understand how money works. They get that it's not about just consuming. It's about putting that money to work for you. The wealthiest people, money is working for them. They aren't working for their money anymore.
What you guys are talking about kind of touches on another attribute that Thomas Stanley talks about that's very important for those who are millionaires is discipline. In his book, The Millionaire Mind, he said that nearly all the top 1% of wealth holders in America reported that being well-disciplined was very important in explaining their socioeconomic success. And so that they were able to focus on their goals. That was another of the attributes. They were able to focus on a goal and make it a success. They're, you know, not distracted by the shiny things off on the side, but they're able to focus on those goals. And they're disciplined, so they're able to sit down, realize that educating themselves is an important part of building wealth, and again, spending that time, their time, in ways that helps to promote building that wealth. So.
Who is it that I can't remember the name offhand, but that had the cookie test, where it's like you offer a kid a cookie and you're like, you can eat this now.
Oh, the marshmallow experiment.
A marshmallow. Okay, maybe I just want a cookie right now. you know, you can have this right now, or you could wait an hour and then you can have two. And that really showed how successful they would be with discipline later on in life.
Yeah, that's actually something. They did it at Stanford, and it was like a series. It was part of a series of studies. And it's something that they talk about a lot in developmental psychology, and something that my husband has talked a lot about. He's a psychology professor. But they talk about that a lot. Yes, it's part of like development. It's part of delayed gratification. And there's also something about understanding in your mind and having that process and being able to like look ahead and plan ahead and do that calculation in your head. It's not just about, oh, can I have the discipline to wait? But it's also about thinking ahead and being able to compare your current state and your possible future state.
My fiance is actually doing this marshmallow test with her grade three. She's done it over the last week, and she's sort of written the results down and documented it a little bit so that at grade 12, we'll sort of see if there's any correlation to grade 12 marks. I look forward to seeing the results of that. I know the immediate results are quite humorous.
I was just going to say, I'm going to get me a bag of marshmallows and see if I could tease my kids out some discipline. See what happens there. But it is an interesting thing. You know, it's hard to give up that here and now for later on. I think for a lot of people, myself included, you know, and it's not just about money. It's a lot of different things. You know, it's how many people want to lose weight or exercise or do whatever. You know, everything is going to take some kind of small sacrifice now, or as we've talked about, find your value and what's important to you right now. And are you willing to sacrifice for that, instead of taking some shortcut somewhere else? So what other traits haven't we discussed yet in the millionaire mind?
Well, one of the things that I like that Warren Buffett once said, and it goes kind of back to investing and investing in yourself and figuring out how to make yourself marketable. But he said, anything that improves your own talents, nobody can tax it or take it away from you. You can have all kinds of things happen, but if you've got talent yourself and you've maximized your talent, you've got a tremendous asset that can return tenfold. I really like that. And I think one of the things that millionaires do, the wealthy do, is really invest in themselves and look at how they can improve. Look at people like Thomas Stanley or Warren Buffett or any of these other people. They're always improving themselves. They're always looking for something new, something different. They're always challenging themselves. They're looking for some sort of a mission. They're looking for just some way to improve themselves. And a lot of them don't stop. You know, there's no real retirement for them.
Yeah. It sounds like what you're saying is, you know, you want to just have that spirit of maybe taking chances or always looking to improve and not be so insular and maybe afraid, you know, go out there and do something different. I don't know who says it, but do something every day that scares you.
I like that.
I can't be attributed with that in any way, shape, or form. But yeah, it does sound kind of like a cool thing as long as it's nothing too scary. But the people that get ahead, they are multi-skilled. When you read about these people who build successful businesses, and every one of us here, we understand, you know, when you run something on your own, you're wearing so many different hats that there is no one skill set that'll do it for you. You know, you have to be pretty well-rounded to get ahead. And I think it also protects you too, that the more skills you have and the more that you have maybe under your belt, the more protection you have if you lose your job or something doesn't work out, you have to find something else. You know, it's easier to pivot then and find something new.
I reviewed a book recently. It's sort of aimed at the Canadian market, but the principles are pretty straightforward. It's called Wealthing Like Rabbits, which is a great name. And the fella was talking, and that's Wealthing Like Rabbits, just if you didn't hear me correctly. He had a great section on being, penny wise and pound foolish. And I think in North America, we sometimes skim over that. We're like, okay, ignore the lattes. We're going to make yourself a millionaire by not getting coffee, but go ahead and own a 4,000 square foot home in a climate where you're going to have huge hydro costs or electricity costs, and go ahead and do all these huge things. If you're already spending 30 grand on a wedding, well, 35 grand is not really that much of a deal, and you're only going to do it once. Once again, to use my grandparents as an example, like this is an ancient history. I know these people. They raised a family of 10 in a 1,200 square foot home. And now a 1,200 square foot home is always labeled as a starter home or a retirement home in classifieds. And I think that people don't understand the huge hindering effect that can have on your wealth when you have a $300,000 or $400,000 or $500,000 mortgage. Even if you're making a slightly higher than average income, that's going to really cripple your ability to invest money at a young age or even middle age or pre-retirement as far as that goes.
And usually along with that mortgage, you probably – probably paying taxes that are
insurance
that aren't standing still. You know, a lot of people make that assumption that, you know, okay, I have my fixed mortgage. That's good, right? So every year, maybe I make a little bit more and then that mortgage gets less and less, but taxes don't stay the same. They rise also. So even though your mortgage might stay the same amount, it doesn't mean that that's all you're ever going to spend on housing. You know, that number changes, you get taxed more, your insurance goes up, the repairs come in, you know, there's always something more to it. And the bigger that house is, the more that other stuff kind of eats up your finances.
I don't think people understand just how big a deal buying a house is for most people in their financial life. It's not just another big financial decision. It is in many ways the financial decision if you choose to own a home. I know Miranda is certainly a good advocate for not owning a home, and we discussed that before on the show. But if you are going to own a home and join that cult of home ownership that we have here in North America, don't cripple yourself. It's so easy to make that one wrong decision, and you can make a lot of good decisions from there on out, but it's not going to sort of bear the fruit that it could if you're not willing to maybe live within your means on that one specific area.
People think we're crazy that we moved into an apartment and we're renting, but hey, I feel much better about the situation now.
Yeah, again, laugh all the way to the bank, right?
That's right.
I think a lot of it goes back to that, you know, we live in such a consumerist society these days where it's almost like people think they can find happiness through having a bigger house, or, you know, I'll be content once I have that 3,000 square foot house with a 3-car garage and an ATV in the third stall, and, you know, all that
marble
stuff.
Marble countertops. It's all about the marble countertops if you watch
it. Gotta have the marble.
It's true. Yep. And steel appliances.
But the truth is, you know, those things or the wealth themselves are not going to make you happy. Again, going back to that Quora post where I was reading about what these millionaires were saying, time and again, they just kept saying, even when they got those millions, it didn't make them happy. And having the money in the end, you know, for a lot of them wasn't really the end goal. It was more about having freedom to do things and being able to be more generous and give to other people or help people in their family or things like that. So that's something else to keep in mind, I think, is that having a lot of money, having a lot of things, any of those things are not likely to make you happy.
And I think that that's a good point, though, that you make about being able to give to people. one of the things that Warren Buffett is big on is he talked about giving back and the importance of giving back. And I think that that's something to remember is, you know, what do you want to do with your money? Is it the end itself, or is it a means to an end, whatever that end you really want?
Especially once you've kind of built up the lifestyle of you're earning this money, but you're not spending it like Warren Buffett, then you can look at things like causes that you want to donate to easier compared to, like, I've known real estate agents that were making all sorts of money, but they were blowing it just as fast and they couldn't even pay their bills, even though really they're making an income where they could be a millionaire in 5 years if they just treated a little better.
Yeah, money buys you options. Stuff doesn't give you the options.
One of the things that you do have to watch out, one of the pitfalls when you start saying, well, I want to be a millionaire, and you're like, this is my goal, and it's like millionaire or bust. I think one of the things you do have to watch out for is getting so caught up in, no, this is the new status symbol, is how many millions I have or how much money I have. And so instead of being like, well, what do I want to use this money for and how can it enrich my life and the lives of others? You start being like, well, this is the end goal. And it becomes this like big pissing contest with everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah, I always get a kick out of that because people are like, you know, inevitably they'll hear if I've taught my students something in personal finance, or perhaps someone's asked me a question because they know I wrote a book about money. They'll be like, oh, well, when are you going to be a millionaire then? Almost like it's a challenge. Like if you're legit, you should already be a millionaire. And then my response is, to be honest, given my life's goals, I highly doubt I'll ever be a millionaire. I have a defined benefit pension plan, and it's quite unlikely I will ever have $1 million in investable assets. If I do, it won't be till quite late in life, almost as like a fringe side benefit of good habits I've put into play. I doubt at the day I retire, I'll have $1 million. And they're like, well, you don't know anything about money then. Okay, whatever.
But that defined pension plan is sort of like a phantom $1 million.
It is. Right? It's and I try to explain that, but then people just get mad because they're like, oh, that's my tax dollars. It's sort of after tax dollars. Never mind.
In fact, it's probably like having a few $1 million that the state puts aside for you and just lets that money earn money for you.
Being a millionaire is not so much about being a millionaire as you were talking before about options. And I don't need $1 million to be happy. I get to live a lifestyle that I enjoy. I get to set my own hours for work. I work from home. If I want to go do something with my son, I can go do something with my son. If I want to go party in Las Vegas or Charlotte, I can go party in Las Vegas or Charlotte. So it's all this, I don't have to worry about that kind of stuff. So building up a huge pile of money isn't my priority. I do set aside money for retirement because I want it to be there later. But at the same time, my priority is can I live the lifestyle I want and meet my goals while still being able to prepare for the future? And to me, that's more important than saying, well, I'm going to pick an arbitrary number. And let's be real, saying millionaire or $1 million, that's kind of arbitrary. That's just a number that somebody picked out as saying, oh, this is good. I don't need to live up to an arbitrary number. I think it's more about the mindset that gets you there and lets you have those choices.
Yeah, it's nice to get to a point where you're just like, this is good. I don't need to have this, that, and the other thing. I've got some options now. I got some choices. I'm not completely stressed. And yeah, it doesn't have to have some dollar monetary figure on it. So I think we've talked a lot about what the traits of the millionaire are. And, you know, I think this is something that we all have talked passionately about in some way, shape, or form. Either on our sites or on this show as well. So we could probably sit here and keep talking about this. But we'll wrap up here and we'll go around the room and we'll do a final word on millionaire traits. So Kyle, what's your final word on the traits of millionaires?
My final word is just pay attention. It's sort of, sweating the stuff you can or you should be sweating and not worrying about the rest of it. So in other words, worry about, paying as little in taxes as you have to legally, maximizing your talents, like Mariah was saying, and ignore stuff like, you know, your ultimate return on income. You can't control what the markets are, or your return on investment, excuse me. You can't control what the markets are going to do. Don't obsess over 0.2% return on income at the expense of all the other things that are much more important in building wealth and that you have more control over.
And Miranda, what's your final word on millionaire traits?
The traits that make a good millionaire don't necessarily need to drive you to this yardstick like I was talking about before. It's more about learning how to use money to your advantage. It's about how you use money and how you put money to work for you. to create the lifestyle you want. So I think it's less about trying to find a specific number and more about trying to figure out what's going to work for you and how to do it without working yourself to death.
Yeah, because if you work yourself to death, you really can't enjoy it anyway.
That's right. What's the point?
Peter, what's your final word on millionaire traits?
I'll go back to Thomas Stanley. One of his books was called Stop Acting Rich. And
that's a good one.
Part of the idea behind it is just you can either act rich or you can actually be rich. So try not to worry too much about, you know, keeping up with the Joneses and living kind of a subsidized lifestyle. But worry more about finding out what you value in life, what your priorities are, and then having some discipline in your life in order to build wealth and build some freedom in your life so you can do the things that you want to do with your family and your friends.
And Tom, what's your final word on millionaire traits?
Becoming a millionaire is basically just the accumulation of positive cash flow. Like, you have to work hard, you have to take some risks, but then once you have that money, you have to also not spend it all. You have to sort of have some control with what you're with your money in the first place. Yeah, that's basically it. Just you need to earn the money, but you also have to save it.
Thank you, Thomas J. Stanley, for your research and your time. Thank everybody in the PF realm. I can say we're going to miss you. You know, you had a lot of wise stuff that you were able to unearth for us. If you want to know about being a millionaire, go find his stuff and read it. And until next week, be good with your money.
Thanks for joining us on the Money Mastermind Show. Get more information at moneymastermindshow.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on iTunes and YouTube and follow us on Google+.